explained, we'll now get a little bit of a historical background to the various captivities, the attacks made by the king of Babylon upon the land of Israel, and so on. I'll read now from page 428 in the book Prophets and Kings, which says, when early in the reign of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar for the first time besieged and captured Jerusalem, and carried away Daniel and his companions with others especially chosen to service the court of Babylon, the faith of the Hebrew captives was tried to the uttermost. We're plainly told there that there was early in the reign of Jehoiakim when Nebuchadnezzar made his very first attack upon the land of Judah and the city of Jerusalem, that Daniel and his three friends were carried captive to the land of Babylon. Now let's go back to 2 Kings, the 24th chapter, in which we read about the good reign of good King Josiah. It turned out to be the last good king that ever reigned in either Israel or in the land of Judah. He was a good king, but unfortunately he died in battle fighting against the Egyptians, and that brought to an end his good reign. Now he was followed by a king who reigned but a scant 3 months. You read this in 2 Kings 24 and verse 31. Well, let's read verse 30. And his servants carried him, that is, Josiah, in a chariot dead from Megiddo, and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own sepulchre. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his father's stead. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. Now, the relation, I would say, of course, to Jeremiah the prophet. Now, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, was a bit of a kingmaker at this point in time. And when Jehoahaz failed to measure up to King Pharaoh's demands, he was put in chains in Riblah, as you read in verse 33. And then in verse 34, when Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah, his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim, and took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. So now we find that two sons of Josiah in succession are kings of the land of Judah. And it was during the reign of this man Jehoiakim, who began at the age of 25 years, as you read in verse 36, to reign over Judah in the city of Jerusalem. It was in his reign that Nebuchadnezzar came up for the first time against the land of Israel, as you now read in chapter 24. In his days, in Jehoiakim's days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldees, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the words of the Lord which he spoke by his servants the prophets. As I said before, this was the time, we read it from Prophets and Kings, when Daniel was taken captive into Babylon. Now, upon the death of Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, an 18-year-old, began to reign in his place, and his reign lasted a bare 3 months. And then Nebuchadnezzar appointed another king whose name was Mattaniah, verse 17 of chapter 24, and the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead, and changed his name to Zedekiah. And Zedekiah was to reign for 11 years in the city of Jerusalem. And with the fall of Zedekiah, there never again was a king upon the throne of Judah from that day until this. Jesus came, of course, as the next king that was not recognized, of course, as such. Now, on this board, I've drawn a brief diagram to illustrate the rise and fall of these kings. First of all, we have good King Josiah, who died in battle against the Egyptians, followed by Jehoahaz, who reigned for 3 months, then by Jehoiakim, who reigned for 11 years, Jehoiakim for 3 months, and Zedekiah again for 11 years. Now, Daniel was taken captive to Babylon during the reign of Jehoiakim. So therefore, for probably 7 or 8 years of Jehoiakim's reign, Daniel was in Babylon. Throughout the reign of Jehoiachin, he was in Babylon. Throughout the reign of Zedekiah, he was in Babylon. So there's probably something like about 20 years between the captivity of Daniel and the final overthrow of Jerusalem. And that's worth keeping in mind. It's worth keeping in mind because Daniel's witness in Babylon was a living demonstration of the truth of Jeremiah's words as he preached to the Israelites or the people of Judah during those last days of their terrible apostasy. And I think that's quite a very important point to keep in mind as we consider the life story of those great men back there. I turn back now to Proverbs and Kings, page 4-8. I read these words, as an interpreter of the meaning of the judgments beginning to fall upon Judah, Jeremiah stood nobly in defense of the justice of God and of his merciful designs, even in the severest society. Untiringly, the prophet labored, desirous of reaching all classes, he extended the sphere of his influence beyond Jerusalem to the surrounding districts by frequent visits to various parts of the kingdom. So, we find then that Jeremiah spread his influence throughout the length and breadth of the Judean kingdom, that is, the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Now, in the book of Daniel, let's turn to that verse in chapter 12. Naturally, of course, we'll come back to the scripture later, but I do want to make what I feel is a very, very encouraging point at this moment of time. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 3. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Last year, we made the point that many people react to the message of Sabbath rest by feeling that they're deprived of their right to organize their lives, they're deprived of any role as plan makers, that they are reduced, in fact, to being mere automatons. God has all the say, and they just jump to his commands and do as God says to do. And because of this, there are some people who tend to reject the message of Sabbath rest because they want to be in command of their own lives. They want to exercise the powers that God has given to them, and they justify their course of action by saying, well, God gave me the power of reason, God gave me the power to organize, God gave me the power to direct other men. Big question mark after that. And so we want to exercise these God-given powers. And if we don't exercise them, then we shall belittle ourselves and become the losers and not the gainers. Now, that's a fine piece of human reasoning. And I want to demonstrate today, in the life of Jeremiah, the fallacy of that kind of reasoning. Now, first of all, we're told in Ministry Hearing, page 19, in regard to Jesus Christ, it says he glorified his life by making everything in it subordinate to the will of his Father. So, Jesus Christ glorified his life not by being his own plan maker, but by letting God be his own plan maker. Now, while we have our Bibles open to Daniel 12, cast your eye back to Daniel 11, verse 31. And we'll note the final, well, we'll note the whole verse again, where it says, an arm shall stand in his path, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily, and they shall place, now that's the next word, they shall place the abomination that maketh what? Desolate. Now this abomination makes desolate. In other words, the outworking of its activities is desolation. And what's the other word for desolation? Death. A desert, a waste place, an empty place, a place which has been robbed and deprived. Now then, let's now, the final proof of an argument, of course, lies in the outworking of the application of this theory or procedure versus the application of this other theory or procedure. Down through history, which way have men elected to go? Have they chosen to make everything in their lives subordinate to God's will, or they said, no, we have these great powers in ourselves, and we are going to exercise the powers that we have. We shall plan, we shall solve problems, we shall straighten out the world. Now, which has man done? The latter. Right. Now, what has been the result for this world? Has the world been glorified? Has man's life been extended? Has peace and prosperity been brought? Or has this procedure brought a desolating or ruinous effect upon the world? And the answer is self-evident, isn't it? Now, in various parts of the world today, we have absolute despotisms in the form of the Roman Catholic Church, wherever she can really wield that despotism, and on the other hand, in the communist world. And both of these are a despotism. Now, there's no real difference between Catholicism and communism. There's a superficial difference, but both of those gigantic organizations are built around the principle of a few men at the top literally taking God's place over the masses. And who makes all the plans for all the people? Those few men. Who dictates how the rest shall live? Those few men. And the Roman Catholic system, isn't that the same picture precisely? Absolutely. Now, if you travel the world, you'll find a striking contrast between those places where the Christian principle has been exercised to some degree, and where men are given as much freedom as they can possibly handle, which isn't too much these days, and on the other hand, compare those kind of areas with places where Roman Catholicism and, or I should better say, all communism have been the dominant system of rulership for quite a period of time. And you'll find a striking difference in the countries where these two things are to be found. For instance, if you go to let's go down a little south from here to a border town in the USA and pass over to Mexico. Those of you who've done that, what have you found? A different world altogether, right? You pass over a country that's orderly, reasonably tidy, has a high material and cultural standard of living. And when you cross that border, you meet a world of rutted roads and shanty towns and desolation. Now, what makes the difference? Geography? Hardly. That which makes the difference is that down in Mexico, the Roman Catholic religion has ruled for a very long time, ever since the Spaniards came there. And the result is, of course, that abomination has been desolating that country until it's in the Methodism today. And if you go to Peru, or to Portugal, or to the Vatican itself, to Rome, we find, and I personally have found a very striking difference in each of these places. But in America and Europe, where the Protestant religion is dominated, and where men are given their personal freedom as far as possible, we find an altogether different level of culture and prosperity than that found in the countries previously mentioned. Now let's come back now and look at the life of Jeremiah. I read to you last night from the book Prophets and Kings, how that Jeremiah had come to learn for himself and within himself the mighty truth in regard to God the plan maker. And therefore, very obviously, of course, Jeremiah was a true Sabbath keeper. He understood God's rest, he practiced those principles, and he never ever ceased to preach those principles. Now, as you read the story of Jeremiah through, you find he enjoyed perfect protection from the malice of the king and the princes. At one time they're about to destroy him. We hear so much about the deliverance of Daniel from the lion's den, of Meshach and his two friends from the fiery furnace, but how seldom are we told the story or read the story of Jeremiah's deliverance from those princes who planned to destroy him. Perhaps I'll just go back and read a little bit of this to you on page 417. We read about Jeremiah's messages declaring that Babylon was about to come and destroy the land of Judah and carry his peoples captive. Now, those in authority were very hostile to these predictions because they felt that Jeremiah's prophecies would unnerve the people and take away their will to fight and thus leave the city open to attack. They felt that Jeremiah's words would make his prophecy come true. But here we read, had the prophet been intimidated by the threatening attitude of those high in authority, his message would have been without effect and he would have lost his life. But the courage with which he delivered the solemn warning commanded the respect of the people and turned the princes of Israel in his favor. They reasoned with the priests and false prophets, showing them how unwise would be the extreme measures they advocated, and their words produced a reaction in the minds of the people. Thus God raised up defenders for his servants. To the pleading of these men of influence, the prophet's life was spared, although many of the priests and false prophets, unable to endure the condemning truths he uttered, would gladly have seen him put to death on the plea of sedition. And so Jeremiah was miraculously saved from death, even as was Meshach, Shadrach and Abednego, and later Daniel in the lion's den. Not quite so spectacularly, of course, but the deliverance was just as real, and to Jeremiah, just as wonderful. Now, we're coming back to our point then, that despite these threats and intimidations, despite tremendous temptation to do otherwise, Jeremiah consistently and persistently taught the great truth that Jesus Christ is the plan maker, the problem solver, and the burden bearer. Now, what was the result? Let's examine this now. In the first case, as we read last night, the faithful in Israel were enormously strengthened and encouraged by these words. And they were led to rest their case in God's hands and to experience, as we have been doing, the wonderful effect of God being the perfect problem solver. So we can put Jeremiah's name here, and first of all, we can say that the effect was then. That is, right at his own day, the people around him were blessed by his ministry and strengthened in the Lord. But then very shortly after came the battle in Babylon that was fought out by Daniel and his friends, and the real architect of success of that battle was not Daniel, it was Jeremiah. Of course, the real architect was the God of heaven. But by Jeremiah's absolute faithfulness in preaching the truth that Jesus Christ is the one and only problem solver for the church of God, thereby Jeremiah became the instrument for building and guaranteeing the victory for God's church in the land of Babylon, which we shall be shortly studying. We shall shortly be studying. But then, the story in the book of Daniel is to be repeated down here in the last day, when you and I, by studying the book of Daniel, will understand exactly what procedures will bring that final victory. Now, who then in reality is our personal teacher today to Daniel and his three friends? Why, Jeremiah. So therefore, Jeremiah was not only a powerful instrument to guarantee the victory in Babylon, but his influence reaches on to our day to guarantee the victory yet at this time. Now, is that the glorification of a man? The true glorification of a man? Why, absolutely. And while men like Zedekiah, Jehoiakim, and Jehoahaz and those men are but unpleasant memories in the past, and men who will never walk upon the streets of gold because of their iniquitous ways, the name of Jeremiah lives on as a great and powerful influence at the present time. From time to time, new folk come into the movement, more particularly than the older ones amongst us. They raise the question, now we're leaving the big Seventh-day Adventist church with all its security, its immense wealth, its gigantic organization, and so forth, and we're identifying with this little scattered group of people without the kind of organization which holds great movements together, with only a small amount of wealth, with very, very few ministers, and they're scattered all over the world. What guarantee is there that even though we can see that at the present time this movement does have the truth of God and the leadership of God, what guarantee do we have that in the immediate future this movement is not going to fail and leave us stranded out there in the wind, so to say? Well, there are guarantees that this movement is not going to fail. Now, since the days of Daniel, down to this present time, has the truth that Jesus Christ is the one great head of the church, the truth that Christ is the plan maker, and the Sabbath rest involves his occupying that role, when, apart from the expressions of Paul, since the days of Jeremiah, has that truth been so plainly proclaimed? Never has it? Today it is proclaimed with a clarity and a power, the like of which has never been proclaimed before. But we ask ourselves the question, why did it not then succeed in the days of Paul? If we are to believe that the proclamation of these truths today guarantees the success of this movement, then why didn't the proclamation by Paul guarantee the success of that movement? Well, first of all, in the days of Paul, the church was divided. One powerful part of the leadership was determined to do away with Jesus Christ as the one true head of the body and to institute themselves, the members, in the place of Jesus Christ as the head of the body. On the other side, of course, Paul was contending for Jesus Christ being the one true head of every man in the church. We can read those beautiful expressions there in the book of Ephesians and so forth. Now, the time came when, as we learned last year, Paul yielded to the pressure being exerted by the other side, and then after that there was only one force operating in that church, and that was the force determined to do away with Jesus Christ and place man in the place of God. And the only possible outcome, of course, was the papacy. Now, Jeremiah never yielded. He never, ever yielded to the pressures which were brought to bear upon him. Now, there was a time in this movement, back in 1975 in particular, when powerful forces in the movement rose up determined to bring the church back under human leadership, to introduce committees, presidents, and all those kind of paraphernalias that belong to the present Seventh-day Adventist Church Organization, the Roman Catholic Church Organization, the Protestant churches, the government of the country, and every other business or enterprise in the world. Now, fortunately, we had the story of Paul. And as we read that story, we learned what would be the fatal consequences to us if we did what he did. And so, guided by his witness, we avoided that, with the result of that particular power or influence has now been removed from this movement, and I don't know of a single person or group of people anywhere in the world field today who is fighting to displace Jesus Christ as the head of the church and make men to be the head of the church in the place of Jesus Christ. Now, Jeremiah understood. He understood the place of God in the church. And we as a people, the custodians of this great message, must have learned what we saw last year in the study of the Sabbath rest, and what we'll see this year in the book of Daniel, that the only pathway to victory, the only pathway to victory, the only pathway to glory and glorification, is that we keep Jesus Christ as the one true head in the church over every man and woman in that church. And the moment that any one of us, in any way, tries to make himself or herself the head of any other person in the church, in that moment, that person is wielding an influence which, if it spreads and develops, will destroy the church and require God to call yet another people to finish the work in these last days. Now, I could not express more strongly my recognition of these principles and my determination to be as faithful as Jeremiah in forever resisting in this church any influence designed to bring man into the place of Jesus Christ as any kind of head whatsoever. And the last thing I personally want to be is the head over any man or woman in this church. Now then, while we as a people keep before our eyes those principles and stand by them, even though the heavens fall, then what hope is there of this movement failing if we do that? There's no possibility. No possibility whatsoever. And we shall join the illustrious Jeremiah, the remarkable Daniel and his three friends, and Paul, even though he did fail in the end. And in these last days, we shall be men and women to be wondered at, the instruments through whom God at last can finish the work and bring it to a short end. But be it known to us all, that if we do not remain absolutely loyal to those principles, if in any way at all we start to put ourselves in God's place, then just as certainly this movement cannot succeed. It cannot succeed. It will fail, as have all the movements that have gone before us. Never let us, of course, take the attitude, as the Seventh-day Adventist Church has done, that God called us, therefore we just can't help but go through. We can fail. That's a very, very clear lesson from history. Now, Jeremiah, as we already have noticed, brought a message which was not very popular to the king and the princes and the nobles of his country. And they charged him with actually being an agent of the king of Babylon. They said, "Your preaching strengthens the king of Babylon and weakens our own forces, and therefore the influence of your words will fulfill your words." But what Jeremiah was really saying to them was that your course of action of apostasy and rebellion has brought you to that place where, unless you repent, the destruction of this nation and of the city and temple is inevitable. Well, of course, they wanted to put out the siren. They wanted to put out, they wanted to smash the thermometer. They wanted to do away with the warning lights. You know, if you're driving down the car, down the road in your car, and the red warning light comes on and tells you that your oil is low, and you say, oh, what a nuisance. And then you reach out and you smash that little light. Does that mean that your car is not going to start falling apart in a few minutes? Not at all. And so if they had killed Jeremiah back there, it would not for one moment have prevented the fulfillment of his words. They would still have come true. Now, as we saw from this historical outline here in this other little board, Jeremiah was prophesying in Jerusalem throughout the whole period of Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah's reign and beyond that. So while Jeremiah was prophesying in Jerusalem, Daniel was demonstrating in Babylon. Daniel was demonstrating that if one would obey the commandments that Jeremiah outlined, then he would be prospered and blessed and would reach very, very high positions, and Babylon would have no power over him whatsoever. Now, make no mistake about it, of course, the news of what was taking place in Babylon was most certainly conveyed back to the Israelites. And the unbelievable victories being gained by Daniel and his three companions would be daily news. Well, it would be daily, but it would be news whenever it came through back in the land of Judah. So there was Daniel and his three friends demonstrating what Jeremiah was preaching. But how much impact did the added demonstration have upon the people of Judah? So determined were they, so mad were they, so foolish were they, that they still were determined that they would gain the victory by human planning. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar came back again and again and again. There were at least four or five crusades or sallies against the Israelites, during which time Nebuchadnezzar progressively broke down their power till toward the end of the reign of Zedekiah. The king was so furious by the betrayals of Zedekiah and previous kings that he burnt the temple and smashed down Jerusalem, took all the people away prisoner, and left the place in absolute and complete desolation. The Israelites just simply would not learn. They just simply would not learn. They seemed to be totally unable to read the lessons of history. And of course, those of us who fail to read the lessons of history, where do we find ourselves? Making the same dumb mistakes all over again, right? When you don't learn the lessons of history, then history will be repeated, and we'll go for the same sad procedures as they went through previously. Now, with a little background in view, let's go now to the first chapter of the book of Daniel, and we'll now commence a more direct study of the activities of these four young men. Read in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And as we saw before, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, which was 8 years before his reign ended, came the captivity of Daniel and his three companions. And as I've shown you here, of course, after the death of Jehoiakim came Jehoiachin, and then Zedekiah, which meant that something like 8 years, 19 years and 3 months before the final fall of Jerusalem, Daniel was a captive in the land of Babylon, demonstrating there what Jeremiah was preaching back in the city of Jerusalem. Daniel 1 verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried to the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. Now then, at this point we'll now begin to look at the powers which are brought to view in the book of Daniel. The powers as they were seen by Nebuchadnezzar as he went to war against the people of Israel. Now, in the book of Daniel itself, we don't find the name of Egypt mentioned, but we will mention it here because it does have a part to play. First of all, the first power which is mentioned, of course, is Babylon. A world empire at that time, led by an extremely energetic, highly intelligent, strong king whose name was Nebuchadnezzar, the first great king of the Babylonian Empire.
Now, the Babylonian Empire has succeeded what great empire?
Very good, the Assyrian Empire.
And it had been the Assyrian, not the Babylonian Empire, which had taken, which had attacked and taken away the members of the other 10 tribes of the land of Israel. And this had taken place well over a century before this point of time. Now, as we said, Babylon was a very, very successful empire. And its success had come from the application of human planning. And we'll emphasize the fact, of course, during this study series, that human planning in certain situations and contexts can bring to men enormous success. After all said and done, how are great American corporations like Xerox and IBM and Remington Rand and so forth, and all the gas companies too, like Exxon and Shell and Mobil and so forth, are they planned by God day by day, or are they built by human planning? They're built by human planning, right? So we have to recognize the fact that human planning can bring tremendous success, but always at a cost in human suffering and human lives. Did Nebuchadnezzar ascend the throne up steps upon which there were no drops of blood? No, he didn't. On the contrary, there were literally rivers of blood that were shed in order to give that man world dominion. And what nation upon the earth which has built a power by human planning has ever succeeded in gaining power excepting at a tremendous cost of human suffering and human lives? Now, secondly, we shall also learn that while human planning brings great success up to a certain point, there comes a limit. And that limit we'll find revealed again and again throughout the book of Daniel. And when that limit is reached and no further growth can be made, then very suddenly and disastrously, in the case of Babylon, she comes to her total and complete ruin, never again to be inhabited or lived in or in any way to be alive whatsoever. So then, we find now a great kingdom which was built upon the principles of man the plan maker. This was PM there for man the plan maker. Now we have another power brought to view in these stories, and this is apostate Israel. Now, how did they come to this level of apostasy? Because they too were a nation that was built on man the plan maker in the place of God the plan maker. Now, as we saw last year, what is it that makes Babylon to be Babylon? Man in the place of God. So literally, what was apostate Israel in actual fact? It was Babylon, right? And so Babylon was fighting against Babylon. Now, a third power brought to view in this whole setup, of course, was the land of Egypt. And Egypt, once again, was a nation built upon man, the plan maker. But finally, a little company of people upon the world at that time, which we shall designate here true Israel, or if you prefer, the true Church of God, this alone was that organization of people, because they were scattered and not too well organized from a worldly point of view, but this was the only group at that time on the face of the earth which recognized God as the plan maker. The only group existing at that point of time. And of course, we can put down the illustrious name of Jeremiah as being the foremost teacher of those principles at that time. And together with him, there was Daniel plus his three companions. And hidden from view and not particularly brought to light in the book of Daniel, there were other faithful ones, of course, who likewise were taken into captivity or in some cases may have remained back in the land of Israel with Jeremiah. Jeremiah did not go into captivity. He remained in the land of Israel, unless I'm mistaken there, when Nebuchadnezzar finally took them all away captive. Now, we want to look now at Nebuchadnezzar's evaluation of this whole thing. Now, he did not particularly consider Egypt to be a major adversary, because the Egyptian power had been literally broken when Israel was taken out of that country centuries before, and Egypt had never become a significant world power again in the meantime. Its power had been broken and had never fully recovered. It had been attacked by the Amalekites and various other tribes and progressively reduced, but it had regained a measure of power and was allied to the Israelites in Jerusalem and Judah and Benjamin, about the time when Nebuchadnezzar began his world conquest, and so on. So when Nebuchadnezzar overcame Egypt, he was not particularly impressed by that victory. It was just something he expected anyway. But Israel was different. Now, we saw yesterday the difference between the message that went forth in 1844 and the message which followed that in 1859. We made the observation that modern Adventists are not able to distinguish between these two Adventisms, and they think that they're both the same. Now, in like manner, Nebuchadnezzar back there saw no difference between apostate Israel as such and the true Israel. To him, they was all one and the same thing. Therefore, when he conquered apostate Israel, what did he think he'd overcome? Right, he thought he'd overcome true Israel. Now, apostate Israel had, attending it, a great deal of fame which had been earned not by apostate Israel, but by true Israel. In other words, when they left the land of Egypt, when they crossed the Red Sea, defeated the Amalekites, drove out the various tribes in the land of Canaan, brought down the walls of Jericho, all those tremendous achievements had been kept by apostate Israel, who claimed that they were their achievements. But in real fact, of course, they were not. They were the achievements of true Israel under Joshua and the other great leaders that lived back in those old times. Now, Nebuchadnezzar went to war against Jerusalem, and he had no doubts in his mind that this was a nation to be overcome, because they boasted that they had the true God. They boasted about their previous victories and so forth, and therefore, to King Nebuchadnezzar, this was the most important single achievement to be gained in all the conquest in his realm. And so, when he gained the victory over those who he supposed to be God's true people, he thought, now, if I can win the victory over those who profess to worship the true God, who has in the past gained these great victories for his people, then what power on the earth can stand against me? And as he reasoned like that, as he naturally would, being a proud Babylonian king, he came to conclude that his was indeed and in fact an eternal kingdom. It could not and it would not ever pass away. There was no possibility so far as his thinking was concerned. Of course, he was to learn some very, very deep lessons very shortly as he came into direct conflict with the true Church of God. And God was able to lay some very, very wonderful plans, because God had workmen in whom he could put his entire trust. Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, men who would not start to add their planning to God's planning and thus mess up God's plans altogether. Because God had those faithful workmen back at that time, God could bring revelations to King Nebuchadnezzar, which at last convinced the king that there was a difference between apostate Israel and real Israel, and that whereas he thought he'd overcome real Israel, he found them to be an absolutely unconquerable people. And we'll learn as we go on that in every confrontation, every battle that was fought between Daniel on the one side and King Nebuchadnezzar on the other side, that there was no question about who was the winner in every one of those contests. It was God through Daniel every time. But remember, only because Daniel, because of Jeremiah's teaching, kept God ever before him as the source, as the plan maker, the burden bearer, the problem solver, and so on. But now, time has gone for the study. We have to stop at this point. We'll come back shortly and continue with the next study hour. It's now exactly 10:30. Let's take a 20-minute break and come back at 10 to 11, shall we? 20 minutes, 10 to 11.